Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. I'm so glad you're joining me today. We have got one great show for you. And I'm here in the Progressive Radio Network studio, and I'm looking at the beautiful blue eyes of John Joseph, my guest. They are blue, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Very blue.
Very blue. And I'm really excited to have him here and to speak with him. We're here to talk about the re-release of his book, The Evolution of a Cro-Magnon, where he recounts his hard times and spiritual redemption in this autobiography, a traumatic childhood. That is a gentle way to put your story, John. In foster homes, just the beginning of John's evolution. He fronted one of the most important bands in the underground punk scene, the Cro-Mags, as well as Blood Clot. And he faced homelessness, addiction, betrayal, and insanity. And today, in 2017, he is one awesome specimen of a man. And I'm very happy to know you, John Joseph.
Same
Welcome
here.
To It's All About Food.
And thank you for having me back. It's been about
seven years. Yep.
Jesus.
So you were last here.
Might I say that you've aged like a fine wine? You look great there.
Thank you. You know,
and that's coming from a sober person.
I wanted to say, my birthday is this Saturday. It's Earth Day, my birthday.
Beautiful.
I will be 59, and I'm 4 years older than you.
Wow.
And I want to talk a little bit about that, because we were growing up in the same scene, in some of the same places, and when I read your book,
did it bring back memories?
It brought back memories, and your book is... I mean, there are no words. I was just heartbroken through the whole scene that we live in a world that is so cruel.
Yeah. And I just gave the book to someone else, and a friend of mine, and she said, I can't believe the stuff that foster family did to you. And I said, listen, there's people out there doing a lot worse stuff to kids. I've heard, because I work with kids who are incarcerated.
Yep.
And I go to prisons and I speak and go to high schools and, you know, lockups. And I get a chance to mentor these kids. And, I mean, the stuff that I went through, as crazy as it was and messed up, there's a lot worse stuff that goes on to kids nowadays. You know,
when I read that, because you say that a number of times, that what you went through isn't as bad as what you've heard other people have gone through, is just mind-boggling. You talk about your foster mom in this one situation where you were fed what you called the spit Oreo on white
spit
bread
sandwiches.
This show is called It's All About Food, so I like to bring up the food items, but she would scrape the cream off with her mouth.
With her teeth, and she didn't like the cream. She just liked the wafer, so she would spit it in a bowl.
And that was your bread.
And then whatever moldy bread was laying in the bottom of the bread drawer, she would put it on that. And that's what we got fed every single day with tea, and that was it. And they fed us the same food as they did the dog at the same time to show us where we fell on the food chain and how insignificant. I mean, the whole time we were there for almost 7 years, they just tried to make us feel insignificant and worthless. And they told us constantly, nobody else wants you. You're lucky to be here. I mean, even that stuff for taking me to the nut house and saying, if I open my mouth, this is where I'm going to end up, and no one's ever going to know you're there. And
I remember you wrote about Pilgrim State.
Pilgrim State. Yeah. That's people wonder how come kids keep quiet. They put the fear of God into you. And that's why and the other thing was, my mother was suicidal. We went home on one visit, and she tried to cut her wrist and take a bunch of pills, and we had to call my uncle because we asked when we were coming home. And she flipped out. So we knew not to say anything, because if she has another nervous breakdown, we're never going to come home. So that's where that whole diary came in. And we hid this diary. My brother came up with the idea to just write down everything that they did to us. I mean, when we finally left that home, the social worker broke down crying.
Sure.
And the thing was, you know, I always say people that hustle on the streets, if you look at the history, it's you're not born that way.
Mm-hmm.
You do that as a result because the human instinct is to survive. So whatever we had to do to eat, and there's humorous moments even in the form, like, mm-hmm. you know, they were taking us and they're like, you know, how the hell are these kids gaining weight? Like, but we were stealing. We found out where they kept the money because that's what they were doing it for. They had six kids and getting $300 a month for care, clothing. Clothing, we had to just wear stuff till it fell off and then go back to the poor box and pick out more clothes. They never bought us clothes.
Mm-hmm.
We never got clothes the entire time we were there. We were never allowed in the refrigerator the entire time we were there. They kept us in a garage, sleeping on cots and this dirty den and had to sit out in the patio in the freezing cold. Christmas time, you'd be hearing them celebrating and we're out there, you know. So it was a lot of stuff to deal with, but it was the humor that got us through. And then the fact that we were able to start getting over on them. But even when we stole money from them, we basically ate just enough, but we always bought my mother gifts thinking, mm-hmm. like, if we buy her this,
yep.
you know, we bought her art. And I stole a fish tank one time out of a damn aquarium, like a 25-gallon fish tank running down the street with it because she said she wanted a fish
yep.
tank and it was calming.
Right.
I mean, and then we had to hide it until we got, like, hide it in the woods until, you know, her boyfriend who didn't want us around.
Yeah,
I won't say what we were doing, but they have a term for that, you know, when we're getting in the way of his sex
sure.
life.
Yep.
So that's why he didn't want us around. And
now ultimately you were there for him and his demise
you
later
see that?
On. Yep.
Because that was the arc of the growth. I mean, that her telling me, you know, us, you know, we've become a lot closer since the release of the book and all of this stuff. That went on because
your mother did terrible things, but you now understand
why
she was
going
through.
Went through. My father raped her twice, and that's how me and my younger brother were born. We didn't know that. She didn't
yeah.
tell me that till I was 40. And even that moment was so powerful because I just kept hurling hurtful things at her because she let that man move into the house that I got when her husband gambled away the house behind her back, and then was he was a recovering alcoholic. He was in AA, but he became a gambling addict and gambled the house away. So when they went and he was hitting her, had I known that, I would have beat the crap out of him after what my father did to my mother. She never told us. And then when they went to get divorced, she had nothing because
mm-hmm.
he gambled away the house. And then I was doing good at the time. I signed a record deal and all this other stuff. So I go in and I get her an apartment. I mean, she left with nothing, like her clothes in boxes. I had to buy a furniture, a TV, get her an apartment, all of that. And then she turns around and tells me, I got to tell you something. The man who didn't want you around, who you were abused for 7 years, I let him move in. That's when it hit the fan. And it was just, and since she told me her side of the story and the book and all this stuff that's gone down, and I was there for her. And then when he passed away from cancer, you know, he sat on my stoop, and he was a big guy. He worked for Con Ed. He was one of these burly Con Ed dudes. He was down to about 115, 120 pounds, dying of cancer, and sat on. This was my mother never put him in a hospice. She took care of him, and this was right before he went into the hospital, maybe a week before and he sat on my stoop with tears in his eyes and asked for me to forgive him, and I did. And then when he was in the hospital, I went and put holy water on him and played all this stuff to help him transition to the next life, but. Through all of this whole ordeal, we've become a lot closer. But that foster home and it developed a lot of food. You know, thank God that I found And you know what? It was Gary Noel listening to him in 80 and 81 in a squat. And I wrote about that in the book. Like on a little radio. I think it was BAI or something, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Yep. And I listened to him on this little transistor radio. No windows, no plumbing. Dangerous gang dudes trying to come in and take the building from us. And by candlelight. And I sat there taking notes from the stuff I learned from Gary Noel. So that's why when I came in, I was like, oh, man, is he here? I want to meet him and tell him, you know, how much he's affected my life from back in the day. But, thankfully, I found a healthy way to eat because I've had food issues, you know, because of being starved as a kid. I always thought the food was going to run out and I would overeat and all of this stuff. But now it's kind of like I've learned through training for Ironman and diet and all this stuff and writing books and being around guys like Rich Roll and Brendan Brazier's of the world.
We love them.
Yeah, they're next level studs. You know?
I just want to say that this book, The Evolution of a Cro-Magnon,
Cro-Magnon
is just an incredible story. And anyone who is complaining about anything in their life, when you read this book, you're going to shut up because you have been through so much that most people can't even imagine anything like that happening to them. But the most amazing thing is that your heart has stayed open and you are an incredibly good person, and you've been through hell and back, and now you're making so many amazing choices. You're on a healthy vegan diet. You're fit.
Organic.
Awesome. And I just don't understand how you've managed to rise above. And that's...
I got three letters for you.
Yeah.
And I tattooed them on my leg, and I learned it from the Bad Brains in 1980. And it's called PMA, Positive Mental Attitude. That's the next book I'm almost done with right now. I've been working on it for about 2.5 years about PMA. And at the time, I came out of jail because if we fast forward, I was on the streets for almost 2 years, and then I got incarcerated. I was in some of the worst places. A juvenile at 16 could go. I was in Spofford in 78. I spent my 16th birthday there. And then I went upstate for 18 months, 3 months in Spofford, got stabbed in Spofford, fighting every day, upstate in Lincolndale. And then I came out and I got arrested again. And at the time, my mother had been seeing or knew or dated this Navy recruiter and offered me the Navy, as opposed to possibly facing more jail time. So as I always say, and my brother E says, the state didn't raise no fool. We took the Navy, and he got in trouble again. My brother was locked up with me in the same place.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were both on the street. Because at a certain time, we said, you know what? We've went down this road, and we tried to let New York State handle our business and take care of us. And they failed miserably because they never investigated that home. Then they put us in these crazy boys' homes and all these other messed up families, except for the McGowans, who were cool in Garden City. But at that point, we were damaged goods. So they got rid of us quick. And then we just said, you know what? We'll take our chances on the streets of New York. And come on, the streets of New York, 76, 77.
Yeah, I remember you writing about that.
Yeah, it ain't no joke. And
I mean, I was a good little girl going to New York City to see theater when I was in junior high school in the 70s.
Yeah.
And 8th Avenue was a scary place.
I mean, we called it the Deuce back then. It wasn't even called Times Square. And I seen people get stabbed, shot. I mean, personally, I got shot with a .22 in a drug deal. But after coming out of lockup and getting rearrested, I took the Navy. I went to boot camp. We were at Fort Hamilton, ready to ship out, January 3rd, 1980. And my brother said, hey, I know a place right down the block that sells angel dust. We went and bought, I think it was 4 or 5 bags of angel dust. We went to boot camp dusted on angel dust. I'd never been on an airplane before. I went on an airplane high on angel dust and then went to boot camp and woke up and I was like, what the hell? Where am I? But I was in great shape because when I was locked up, I boxed, I lifted weights. In lockup, one of the terms they say is you got to get your weight up. I went into lockup 130 pounds soaking wet. I came out 165 pound beast that trained all the time, played sports, boxed. So I was definitely, and I had this anger issue. But the thing was, even in the Navy, I was smuggling drugs. I was dealing drugs. I was selling acid. I caught a drug case in Norfolk, Virginia. And then I met the Bad Brains. And they had just started getting into Rastafari. And that was the major turning point of my life. And that's, the singer had read Napoleon Hill's books, Think and Grow Rich or whatever, talking all about PMA and all this stuff. And he put it into his lyrics. He had this song called Attitude. And it was like blitz speed punk rock. And then I just took to that. I ended up, you know, the psychiatrist that they had me seeing in the Navy said I was a time bomb waiting to go off. And I did. I exploded on this guy and beat him with paint cans. And then, you know, the whole thing, I was facing going to Leavenworth and I, because of the drug case and then beating this guy on my ship. They had to medevac me by helicopter off the ship in the middle of the friggin' Caribbean on the way to Brazil, back to Puerto Rico. Just every chain of event was like the universe, God, Krishna, whatever, was just laying everything out for me to make this change. And like if I didn't get the infection in my wisdom tooth and have to go to the hospital, like, you know, it was just crazy how everything kept happening. And then I got a hold of, so I split from the Navy and went back and fought these Puerto Ricans in this gang. Crazy stuff. You can't make it up.
Yeah, the book is over 400 pages.
Yeah,
I mean,
my uncle was like, damn, you know, this is like a lethal weapon. You can kill somebody with this book. It's like, he didn't expect, like.
But the what I love about it, and you're jumping around all these things, and you can't get the drama or the intensity unless you read the entire story.
It's taken out of context.
I'm still blown away by this happy ending or this happy beginning.
Well, you know what it was? It was getting into A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami's books, Bhagavad Gita As It Is, and starting to get into yoga and meditation. The Bad Brains, the main thing they told me was you could work with us after I got in this fight, this chain fight. I had a chain and these guys were trying to kill me with knives and I got stabbed in the shoulder, but I fought them and I gained respect on the street. I knew that in lockup. You don't let people do things to you. You know, after what happened to me as a kid, what these people did to me and these other kids did to me in this home, I said nobody's ever putting their hands on me again. I learned how to defend myself. And you know, that's this out of respect. These Puerto Rican gang members were like, and they were they had the number one heroin and cocaine spot in America down in the Lower East Side. And they were like, yo, you're the only one that ever stood up to us. Respect. And then the Bad Brains gave me a job, but the main thing they said was, you could come on a road with us, but you have to eat Itau, meaning pure plant-based. Mm. You can't take drugs and you can't drink. And I said, you know what? You could have told me to worship Skittles and I would because I love the band. But thankfully, and their sound man was a raw foodist who was into Victorious Kovinskis. I met him. I went to see Victorious speak at Integral Yoga Institute.
Right.
Because I worked at Prana Foods. They got me a job in a health food store. I started educating myself. And the catalyst for change was when I stopped eating meat, all of those anger issues subsided.
Wow.
And this, like, amazing aura just kicked in. And I started being like, yo, like, I just, for the first time in my life, I felt peaceful because I just read this quote the other day. When you eat an animal, you're eating every single second of tortured time that that animal has had in its life. You're ingesting that. That's affecting your consciousness. Even Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, all these Vedic teachings say the same thing. You're ingesting the karma of that animal. And when I stopped eating meat and I went on this like raw food diet at first, I was like, wow, the change was just like so dramatic. It was crazy. Then I got into yoga, martial arts, the whole world of higher consciousness just opened up. Then I started chanting Hare Krishna. I lived as a monk for 2 years. and although the leaders after Prabhupada left the planet did a bunch of crazy stuff too. So that was even some next. And you read the book, so you know what I'm talking about. And, it's resiliency. That's what this whole trip has taught me, is resiliency and flexibility. You know, you have to fight through things in life. And that's the code of the warrior is never quit. You never quit. You never surrender.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they drill. Like my boy's in Navy, my boy's an active duty Navy SEAL. I just met him and his kid. He's a team leader too, which means he's responsible for other guys that they make it home alive.
Mm.
And he's one of the most resilient, like never panics in situation. I've learned a lot just from watching what he's been able to do in the last 16, 17 years of his Navy career. And, he took me, he was one of the stars of Act of Valor. So he takes me to the Intrepid for the premiere.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all these, like, Marcus Sutrell, all these SEAL Team 6 guys, like, the baddest of the bad. And he's like, this guy, I used to go on the road with him. He used to take me to the yoga spots. And they're like, what? Like, you know. But you learn a lot. And that's why I try to surround myself by A-type personalities, because I'm trying to learn. I still have a lot to learn.
Wait, we all do. That's what life's about, learning. But I think you are an important messenger for a specific group of people who can understand you and hear you, because you speak their language and you've been through the hell that they've been through. And then you couple that with this open heart. So I imagine you're a great help and provide a lot of hope to the kids that...
Well,
I mean, you do work with... mentor at-risk incarcerated
100%.
Youths.
I just was at Goshenanics, Maximum
Because,
Security.
If I went there, nobody would look at me
to me. You know what? Here's the whole thing. And I'm going to tell you, because I think it was like 6 or 7 years ago, I spoke at the first high school. It was in East New York. All like gang members, Crips, Bloods, whatever. Am I allowed to curse?
You can say whatever you want.
Oh, all right. I didn't know that. Now we're getting off the rated G shit. Here we go. I'm going to tell you exactly what they said. So I walk in, and it was wintertime. I had a coat on. And it's all... So the English teacher read my book. She's like, I would like you to come to these kids because they're all starting to get in trouble. As soon as I walked in, I heard the rumbling. Who does this white motherfucker think he is trying to come here and tell me some shit? What the fuck does he know? So as soon as I got to the library and I started breaking down my story and then telling them what I went through, I had their complete undivided attention. And then I broke out my passport and I started showing them, look where I've been all over the world. You know where all the guys that's locked up and... went through all the stuff that I did. I said, they're either in jail, they're drug addicts, or they're dead.
I
said,
about it.
You're at a point right now in your life where every decision is going to be very, very crucial to how you're going to live your future. And even when these kids are locked up, I met these kids doing 8-10 years in Goshen. They were already sentenced. And I said, look, it's never too late to change, man. You work on yourself when you're inside and you be a better person. You know, you follow the rules. You're going to get out. You're only, whatever, 16, 17 years old. You know, you're still going to have part of your life there.
And that's a universal message.
The other thing is, I just did an interview with my friend who writes for Psychology Today and Huffington Post. And he's, you know, and he's a psychiatrist. He said, you have more effect on these kids than anybody with a degree. Mm-hmm. Because you know what? I walked in their shoes. That's what they're looking. They could care less if you got a PhD. That don't mean shit to them. What means something to them is I understand what they're going through. And that's why I work with these kids. And I get these kids to change their diet and do all this other stuff. I give them books. You know, on...
We just have a few minutes left.
Yeah, okay.
I can't believe the time just flies.
That's what happens when you're having
fun.
That's what they say. The time flies.
I want to talk about your other book, Meat is for Pussies, which...
Thank you for saying the title. Some people don't want to say
it. I have no problem saying it, and I think it's an important book. Now, you had first published it, and then HarperCollins came out and published
it.
You were telling me earlier that you had some challenges with that. Because a lot of people take offense to the title. But what's important about it, again, is you coming from where you came from and the language that you use in the book is a certain group of people are going to relate to you, your language, and your message and hear it and then take positive action.
Right. Well, oddly enough, most of the people that bought that book were women who bought it for their dudes. And I've received thousands and thousands of emails since that book first came out in 2010 and then was reissued from dudes saying, yo, thank you for writing this book because none of these wackadoo vegans were ever getting through to me. The way you put it and the vernacular that the way you talk, dude, it just the
exactly.
light came on. I said, bro. That's the way I learned it. I learned it from guys like HR from the Bad Brains and Daryl and Doc and J.W. Lee who produced their album. I mean, you know, and I, honestly, this guy just got a write-up in GQ magazine. He's the world's, he's a vegan bodyguard, and he's one of the biggest, he's Justin Bieber's bodyguard in Australia.
Oh,
my friend Ian Norrington.
Mm-hmm.
And he's 6'3", 240 pounds, like Muay Thai fighter, and he went on tour with me. I was training for my first Ironman at the time. So everybody else was getting shit-faced and drunk, living the rock and roll fantasy bullshit life. I'm getting up at fucking 5 o'clock in the morning after playing, going for runs, swims, hitting the gym. And he's like, bro, how the fuck are you doing it, man? And I had a copy of my book, Meat is for Pussies. I gave it to him. By the end of the tour, he stopped eating meat, and he's never looked
back.
He even got vegan tattooed on the inside of his lip. When you pull the lip down, it says vegan. But that's the... And then he's gone. He has, like, Hell's Angels working for him in Australia with his prior company, Special Forces guy. He turned around and got all them to go plant-based. So it's a grassroots movement. You're not going to hear this information in the mainstream.
No, but you're going to hear it here at Progressive Radio Network.
That's right. With Karen Harkless and John Bloodclaw Joseph.
John, thank you for coming and thank
love
you for joining
you,
me. And I love you.
Yo, you rock. You're the rock star.
Woo! Okay, thank
and
you.
And say hello to Gary Noel for me. Tell him John Bloodclaw loves him.
I will do that.
All right.
Okay, thank you so
much. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break and then come back and talk about the reducitarian solution.
Everybody, I'm Bhavani, and I'm the host of I Eat Green with Bhavani every Thursday at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week, I discuss food issues in the news, share a recipe, and interview someone in the food, health, or environmental arenas. And I invite you to join me, and you can listen either live every Thursday at 10 a.m., or you can now access my archives directly by dialing 1-701-719-7119. 0880. Please listen in or download me at another time by going into prn.fm and finding me in the archives. Again, this is Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Hope to hear from you soon.
This is prn.fm. Tune in anytime for the latest in progressive news and ideas. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hello, everybody. Test 1, 2. Hello, everybody. Okay, I'm ready for the next part. Oh, I'm all fired up after seeing John Joseph. He is one amazing guy, and I really recommend reading The Evolution of the Cro-Magnon. It's, I mean, if you want to feel something, you will feel a lot reading this book. And the wonderful thing is it has a happy ending. And I think you might be able to find a little bit more compassion when you see people who are homeless or people who are struggling one way or another. When you know their story, you know that it really may not be their fault and that they've been through hell. Okay, but we're here to tune in love, and that's what I like about this show. It's about unconditional love for everybody. That's what we're doing. And it happens to be all about food. Okay, so before I move to my next guest, because I know I'm going to run out of time like I always do, I just wanted to tell you two things. So, Compassion Over Killing, wonderful organization, during the Earth Day period, which is my birthday, April 22nd, Earth Day, they have what they call an annual veg week, and they have a 7-day veg pledge, and I always like to tell people about it. So if you're thinking about moving to a vegan diet for pre-vegans or for reducitarians, which is what we're going to be talking about in a moment, you might want to sign up for the free 7-day veg pledge. You get recipes and tips and more. Go to usvegweek.com. Of course, all year long, you can go to responsibleeatingandliving.com. That's my nonprofit, and you'll get recipes, tips, and more. Please visit my website, too. And then the other thing that's coming up at the end of April is the Food Revolution Network Annual Summit, Summit 2017, and that's with John Robbins and his son, Ocean Robbins. I work with them, and I will be behind the scenes at the summit answering your comments and questions online as you listen to all the interviews. And I'm also introducing a recipe every day of the summit. So that's another fun free event. And if you want to register for that, you can go to my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, and register for the Food Revolution Network's annual summit. Okay, that's done. Check. Now, let's talk about the Reducitarian Solution. And I've got the editor of that book, Brian Kateman. He's the president of the Reducitarian Foundation and editor of the Reducitarian Solution, How the Surprisingly Simple Act of Reducing the Amount of Meat in Your Diet Can Transform Your Health and the Planet. Welcome to It's All About Food. You're right here in the studio with me, Brian.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
You're very welcome. Okay, so I want to talk about this book. And there are things I like about it, and there are some things that make me a little uncomfortable, and we'll talk about all of those things.
It's going to be interesting, okay.
But we tune in love here, so it's a gentle, safe place to be. So first, tell me about the Reducitarian Foundation and your mission.
Sure. Well, what we're trying to do is reduce societal consumption of animal products. When I was in college, I learned all about the impacts of factory farming, not only on our health and the planet, but on the lives and experience of farmed animals, 70 billion of them worldwide every year that are slaughtered. And I decided then I wanted to go vegetarian. I mean, this was an exciting opportunity. I was recycling. I was taking shorter showers. I was that guy on campus who was the environmentalist. But I really hadn't made the connection to food issues. And when I did, it was mind-blowing. And so I decided then, you know what, I'm going to be vegetarian. This is going to be really good. And it was good. I felt healthier. I felt as though my actions were in line with my values. The problem was there were times when I wasn't perfect. And
I remember one Thanksgiving, for example, my sister calling me out across the table, as siblings will do, as I grabbed a piece of turkey. And I thought you were a vegetarian, Brian. And I explained to my sister and my family that, you know, plant-based eating is not about being perfect. It's not an all-or-nothing premise. The more plant-based meals we have, the better our health will be, the better the planet will be, and the fewer animals will suffer. And so I said, you know what, I'm tired of using the word vegetarian. This is not getting at what I want, which is I want to try and reduce the amount of animal products that I can as best I can, but not feel like I have to be perfect about it. And so words like semi-vegetarian and flexitarian do a pretty good job of getting at that. They describe people who primarily eat plant-based foods, but it still felt like there was a large amount of people in my life who may not be interested in veganism or vegetarianism and may not even get to the place of flexitarian or semi-vegetarian, but would be open to reducing the amount of animal products that they consume. And so I collaborated with a friend and came up with this word that would describe someone who reduces the amount of meat they eat. And lo and behold, reducitarian came into existence. And ever since then, I've really been on a mission to educate people on the value of eating fewer animal products, understanding the horrors of factory farming in terms of all the issues we care deeply about, but not worrying so much about being perfect or pure, in a sense. And at the Reducitarian Foundation, we have lots of education and outreach programs designed to engage people with the message. And one of those outreach platforms is the book, which is meant to spread this message to as many people as possible.
Okay, very good. Well, I applaud you for your work, and I agree with the premise. It's horrible what goes on today with factory farming, and your book with all the different voices here, because you have chapters by many different experts and authors that are related to food. They talk about the morality, the ethics behind it, the health issues behind eating plants and animals, and also the environmental impact and the economic impact. We talk about all those things on this program. I've had many of the authors on this show. I love a lot of them, Carol Adams and Jean Stone and Melanie Joy. Let's see. There's a lot of wonderful people here. Nick Cooney, of course, Mark DeVries. Yeah, Ginny Messina. We love them all. Okay. And that's good. I remember in 1987 when Diet for a New America came out by John Robbins. As I mentioned before, I work with John and his son Ocean with the Food Revolution Network. And it was, I would say, groundbreaking at the time. He connected how our food choices affect health, environment, treatment of animals. We weren't hearing a lot about that. There were some undercurrents with the Vegetarian Resource Group and some other groups. But that book really got the message out to many, many people. And John had a message. He wasn't labeling. He wasn't telling people they had to be perfect. But he did talk about how if you reduced your meat consumption by 10%, what a tremendous impact that was. And that was a great message at that time. And John still has that message. He talks about how it's not important to be perfect. And all of that is really good. That was 30 years ago. And I would like to think that we've come further since then, and in some ways we have. I mean, the word vegan is now somewhat mainstream in many circles. We have more vegan and vegetarian foods in supermarkets and on menus. It's a lot easier today than it ever was. We've got soy milk and vegan cheese and all that's wonderful. And now there are investors that want to invest in plant food, processed foods, and fast food restaurants and things like that. All that's wonderful. But I guess some of it is the way some of the people in your book justify doing what they do is what made me a little uncomfortable. So, for example, we've seen this with other movements recently where we compare something we want to change today with something that had happened before. So I could take some of the justifications that people use in the book and compare it to women's rights or civil rights, like compare slaves with animals. And we've come a long way now. Of course, most of us don't believe in slavery, and our laws support that to some degree, even though there unfortunately still are slaves in this country and all over the world. We just may not know about them. It wasn't too long ago that women didn't have the right to vote. I just learned recently from this show that in the 70s, women weren't allowed to bartend, and California was the last state to finally allow women to be bartenders in the early 70s. It's wow. just mind-boggling. And people have used the Bible to justify slavery, that sort of thing. And so I see people justify eating animals in the same way as they've justified the exploitation of women and people of color. And so there's this morality issue. And I'm at a point because the climate, our environment is in such turmoil that I think we need to be shouting this information really loud and not soft selling it as much. That's all. Now, and one more thing I wanted to say. I agree that we can't be running up to people and shouting in their faces, what's wrong with you? You have to be vegan. That never works. We have to come to a place and be loving and non-judgmental and compassionate. Absolutely. But there's like this fine line, because I'm a vegan, and like Victoria Moran said in this book, she would love everyone to be vegan. Me too. And I know that that's not going to happen, or at least not right away. But I think it's wrong to kill animals and to use non-human animals for food, period. That's all.
Well, I think your points are really valid. And, you know, I'm very sympathetic to this argument because I'm extremely concerned about factory farming. I'm not happy that there are 70 billion land animals that are slaughtered each year and that the estimates for fish are so great we can't even figure them out, perhaps in the trillions. I'm not happy that we're seeing climate change accelerated at unprecedented rates, that we're seeing loss of biodiversity, that people are suffering from heart disease, cancer, diabetes. We could go on and on with the problems in the world, and that can feel quite gloomy. So the truth is, though, that, and I think this is to your point, that progress happens incrementally, right? I'm not an expert in these civil rights issues, some of which you mentioned, but my understanding is that if we had been perhaps saying that we want, I don't know, perfect equality for women or for every race, et cetera, we're still not there. I mean, there's still issues in those spaces. And so to be pragmatic, sometimes we have to focus on wins that are achievable. It's great to see that plant-based eating is on the rise and it's becoming more popular. And I am so excited about that, particularly in the future of food space, because most people choose food based on price, on convenience, and on taste. They don't choose foods based on what we're discussing here, even though perhaps we've come to that decision ourselves through ethics or environmental issues or simply perhaps trying to improve our health. Most people are not vegan. Most people are not vegetarian. The percentage of vegans and vegetarian has remained about the same, around 2% roughly for vegans, maybe 5% for vegetarians. A number of studies show that people who are vegan or identify as vegan or vegetarian actually aren't. They occasionally eat animal products themselves. Reducitarianism is inclusive of anyone who's trying to reduce the amount of animal products that they consume, regardless of their motivation or the degree of reduction they'd like to see. So I think Meatless Monday and Vegan Before Six and Weekday Vegetarian, many of these strategies are discussed in the book, are wonderful. But I'm also very supportive of vegetarianism and veganism because those individuals are also reducitarians. It's just that they've done such a good job of reducing their consumption of animal products that they've reduced it to zero. And so I'm worried that there is a certain segment of the population that may not be receptive to veganism or vegetarianism. There certainly are. There are, especially I think a lot of my friends who are young perhaps are really angry at, you know, they're not getting what they want in the political system and they want to go vegan to protect the environment or they're unhappy with animals. But I think of my parents who live in Staten Island, New York. It's not known to be the most progressive.
A red state.
That's right. That's right. I grew up eating buffalo wings at Applebee's, or buffalo wings at Chili's, and a hamburger at Applebee's. My parents to this day say they don't like the taste of fruits and vegetables. I love my parents, but they often say, are you still doing that vegetarian thing? And so I think of them as sort of, I don't know, the average demographic. And I suppose I'm optimistic that people will reduce the amount of animal products that they consume, but may not go vegan. But I want to push this point a little bit further. Imagine that we could get someone who's eating 200 pounds of meat a year to cut back 10%. That would be pretty amazing, right? That'd be 20 pounds.
And that's what John Robbins was saying in 1987. Yeah,
that's it's wonderful. Agreed. And let's say that we could get a person who's eating 5 pounds of meat a year to go vegetarian. That would be a 5 pound reduction. I just feel like we're going to, in this current climate, be able to save more animals, help people and the planet by understanding that there's different motivations and different messaging that will relate to different people. Most people who eat less meat, people who eat less meat are more likely to become vegetarian, and people who are vegetarian are more likely to become vegan. And so I feel as though getting people just started on the path will actually advance all of our shared goals. And that's really what the book is about, is bringing together all these different voices and all these motivations under a shared paradigm. And I'm very excited about that.
I made a lot of notes, and there was something that I remembered, and I'm not quite sure who said it. Maybe it was in the foreword. Anyway, it was talking about the different diets, and here it is. Right here in the foreword, Mark Bittman, who writes, when it replaces or the reducitarian is... Let's start again. It's true that the word itself, reducitarian, is a relatively new one. Whether it replaces or complements flexitarian, parentheses, which is less specific, less meatarian, which is roughly equivalent, vegetarian, somewhat stricter, or vegan, much stricter, remains to be seen. And when I read that, vegan, much stricter, I went, I don't agree with that. Vegan diet is not a strict diet. When you don't see animals as food, you don't see not eating them as something you're missing. It's not strict to me. And I've said this many times, every time I eliminate an ingredient or something from my diet, when I went, my food world expands. So I don't see it as deprivation. I don't see it as strict. I see it as opening my world. And when I see it, things written like that, I don't think it helps. Because people take it in and they go, oh, this is going to be hard because eating less, and if I'm ultimately moving in this direction, it's going to be strict and I'm going to be lacking. And that's not fair.
Well, I think certainly I don't want to misrepresent that plant-based eating can be delicious and it can be achievable. But I also don't want to mislead people who are feeling uncertain and unfamiliar. Mm-hmm.
But when they say a vegan diet is strict, that's misleading them because it isn't.
Well, it's stricter in the sense that it reduces the amount of options.
But it doesn't.
Hmm.
So people are used to grabbing a burger and fries. And when they go vegan, all of a sudden, this whole plant kingdom, there are 45,000 different kinds of legumes. There's so many different kinds of every plant. It's just opened your world and you start to discover them. You start eating a far more varied diet than you ever did before. And I want to see that promoted.
I think that message is in there. I think the word strict just means that you can understand that a person can eat lots of the beautiful plant-based foods on the menu, but when they go to a barbecue, and perhaps in a certain social situation, the only food that's being served is a hamburger or wings, mm-hmm. in that particular moment, they might feel as though their options are limited. Now, I eat primarily vegan food. I love vegan food. I'm making smoothies every day. I've upped my reducitarian game. But when I first started out, it felt intimidating. I don't want to lie. Mm-hmm. It did feel intimidating. I think that the book has a number of tips and strategies that override that message and make it clear that while being perfect and pure can be difficult, and that's not what we're advocating, it mm-hmm. can be easy to eat plant-based foods. I suppose I feel that people are intimidated and fearful, and when they hear that some people, when they hear that they have to go vegan, what they think is they have to give up all the foods that they love, and they haven't quite caught on to the fact, to your point, that there are lots of delicious plant-based foods that are nutritious, good for the planet, good for their health, inexpensive, et cetera. I think putting people on the path and just acknowledging their own emotional experience is important, because otherwise I think it's kind of, I don't know, it just seems agenda-y or misleading to tell a person that it's insanely easy to go vegan today. You should do it right away. There are some people that will resonate with, but mm-hmm. there are others. I know my parents, I've been trying to get them to go vegan for a long time. And I'm just excited right now when they do Meatless Monday. For them, that's a start. My parents can't pronounce the word quinoa. Sometimes I feel as though there's a sort of optimism and a lack of understanding around how challenging it could be for the average, everyday person who may not have these swanky plant-based restaurants here in New York City or access. So, look, if my vote, I want a vegan world. I'm very clear about my agenda, what I'm trying to do. I hope one day we can close Reducitarian Foundation. We can stop using the word reducitarian. We can tell everyone to go vegan because so many people are there. But there are right now a lot of people who are resistant to even mm-hmm. eating a plant-based food once a day. And that's what we're trying to do, is get them on the path.
Let me ask you, I don't know if you've experienced this, but as a vegan, when I meet people either in a business situation or social situation, and I unashamedly, or whatever the word might be, say I'm a vegan, or maybe we're having a meal together, many people have the need to say, oh, I don't eat a lot of meat, or I don't eat a lot of dairy. And why do people say that?
Well, this is part of it. They're threatened, you know. I think
they're threatened because deep down they know there's something to all of this, right?
For sure. I think there are a lot of people who know that factory farming sucks and that it's bad for many of the issues that we care about. And they unconsciously or consciously know that their meat eating in some way contributes to those issues. But this is part of the challenge. Is I think back in the day, I would tell people, you know, it's as many plant-based meals as you can possibly have. People seem to think that it was either you were a vegan or you ate 275 pounds of meat a year. There's a lot of psychological literature showing that people who eat meat are sort of unwilling to adopt this identity as though they care about animals, or because it's that's inconsistent. Our brains don't like cognitive dissonance. We actively mm-hmm. resist it. And so I do think there's a sort of threatening there. That's why when someone says they're eating less meat, I instantly say, that's amazing. You should keep doing that. That's really wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Reducitarian is meant to be a positive identity. And we're not advocating that people have to label themselves or adopt an identity at all. But some literature shows that when people do adopt identities, they're more likely to be consistent with their behavior. So, you know, I hear sometimes I love Meatless Monday, but sometimes it's accused of moral licensing, the idea that people mm-hmm. only do Meatless Monday and they don't go further. I think reducitarian helps sort of convey that this is a gradient. The more plant-based meals you have, the better, rather than sort of locking people into one particular strategy that can be a little bit more rigid.
Okay, let's talk about, there were a couple of places, and I found one of them, and I'm trying to find the other, that had some really great tips. I liked Tanya Luna's element of surprise, mm-hmm. where she talks about surprisify your kitchen, with some fun tips about how to reduce the amount of animal products. For example, use small skillets and plates for meat and large ones for everything else. Keep meat in a closed-off section of the fridge and fruits and veggies easily accessible, and so on. There's many tips like that. And turning eating at restaurants into a game. That sounded fun. Ask mm-hmm. the servers surprise you with a meat-free choice on the menu. Now, that may work for some. I would never let any server surprise me. I have to grill them about everything that's on the dish. But I imagine that could be fun for some people. And then it was Ginny Messina, yeah, who had some excellent tips about offering healthy food for children. I think that would be a great pull-out section just to spread around. Because there really isn't enough in terms of how to feed children healthfully. A lot of parents struggle with that.
Yeah, I think this is a big challenge. You know, just a lot of people are not familiar with plant-based ingredients. So a lot of these tips and strategies, many of them that you mentioned, help people sort of gradually learn and get accustomed to them. And I really liked also Lindsay Nixon's essay, who advocated that people kind of stick to one particular strategy and rule, perhaps. So, for example, perhaps you only eat meat when you go out to eat, but when you cook it, when you cook food at home, you never use animal products. Or perhaps whenever you do eat meat, you make sure that it's a really small portion, so 4 ounces versus 16 ounces. I do think that making the tips kind of, I don't know, somewhat more contextualized and concrete helps people, because eat less meat is sort of vague and mm-hmm. you have to kind of be accountable to yourself. And I agree, all those tips and strategies mentioned in the book are super valuable.
We have a few minutes left, and I could talk about this all day because I love talking about food. I did want to mention one more thing that bugged me.
I love this. Bring it on.
So it was in Michael Shermer's The Moral Arc of Human Rights, and he wrote at one point, where is it? I wrote it down in my notes, about the history, and he said something about how our human ancestors made a tacit bargain with animals. So there was this like silent agreement that we made where we gave them something and they gave us their meat. And I don't think there was an agreement. I don't think the non-human animals agreed with this bargain. And the same argument is used today with, quote, I'm making those air quotes, folks, humane farming, where we're allowing the animals to freely roam within certain confines, and animals are somewhat better treated than in those horrific factory farms. But if you ask the animal if they wanted to be slaughtered, I don't think any of them would raise their hoof or their claw and say, take me next. So that's just kind of like an understanding that we have. And we only have 2 minutes, so just wanted to bring that up because it bugs me.
Well, it's hard to argue with that. And, you know, James McWilliams did write a really great essay about the humane meat myth. I mean, the thing is that 95% or so of animal products come from factory farms. And when they don't, they're usually very expensive and hard to find. And so I'm actually not that interested or really that concerned with the humane meat argument, simply because it doesn't impact most people, particularly in the United States. Perhaps that was flowery language that should have been excised. Mm. I think in general, though, and I really do want to stress this, the book rejects factory farming. It acknowledges that animals experience pain and they experience suffering just like us in all the ways that matter. It explains that factory farming contributes to all of these terrible environmental causes, that it's a simple way to improve your health and live a long time and live a healthier life. And so, you know, to the vegans and vegetarians who are listening, who are, I suppose, concerned with some of the points that you're raising, I think it's just helpful to know that the messaging, the core messaging, I feel, is preserved, that simply eating less meat, starting that journey, is a really good idea. At least half of the contributors are vegan. Most of the recipes are vegan. I want a vegan world. So I really believe that we're all on the same team. And I'd argue that if you know an omnivore who's resistant to the idea of eating vegan or vegetarian, this is a great book to start their thinking, to start them on the path. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it.
I think this is a great conversation, and everybody should be having this conversation. So thanks, Brian Kateman, for joining me on It's All About Food with the Reducitarian Solution. And do I have any seconds left? No. I'm Karen Hartglass. Thanks for joining me on It's All About Food. You can find me at responsibleeatingandliving.com and email me at info@realmeals.org. And here's to a vegan world, and have a delicious week. Oh, one more thing. It's my birthday on Saturday, Earth Day. So everybody, let's celebrate Earth Day on my birthday. Bye.